I'm standing on the beach at San Juan, a tiny port on the eastern side of the island of Chiloé in southern Chile. The rain, as usual, is tipping down, but nobody around me seems to care. There are about 40 people, and they're engaged in the most peculiar occupation I have ever seen. They are moving house. When I say moving house, I mean it, because they're moving the house. It's been lowered onto a kind of raft consisting of logs, and there are in front of me no fewer than 24 beastly looking bulls which are tethered to this house, and bit by bit it's being dragged along the beach. Here it comes now. Quite unbelievable when you see this two-story house. It really is quite a big house moving towards you along the beach.
Patagonia, the very southern tip of South America. From the 40th parallel, it stretches south through Chile and Argentina to Tierra del Fuego and Cape Horn. 500,000 square miles, set in the teeth of the roaring 40s, where some things have hardly changed since the pioneers landed on these same beaches 100, 150, even 200 years ago. I went to look for some of those pioneers in their one-horse towns along the coast or running vast sheep farms in the interior. I walked and hitchhiked south to where the English and Scots had come across from the Falkland Islands to settle on the shores of the Magellan Strait, and then north up the Atlantic coast to the Welsh colonies of the Chubut Valley and Trevelin. The first settlers came with just a kit bag, a few pounds in their pocket, and a determination to make the best of it. Eliza Lewis and Sissy Fraser both arrived about the time of the First World War, one at Santa Cruz, the other at San Julián, both tiny ports on Argentina's Atlantic coast.
Well, to me, of Santa Cruz in those days, there were very few people, but there were lots of English people. There was a hotel we stayed at, was English, yes, and on our way down, it was whilst the Battle of the Falklands was on. That ship turned round to go back. Well, we didn't realize that. Afterwards they told us. And the captain on that boat was German. And I had my 14th birthday on that boat.
The governor of the Falkland Islands came out on the same ship, one of the Pacific Steam Navigation Company, or APESA it was called. And I can remember going into the Falklands and the governor went ashore with the bagpipes playing and the flags flying. And then we came to San Julián on a small one, well, just a dirty little tub.
When we first came, the boats came on the beach, and my parents, they went in a sulky, in a coach, because my mother never learned to ride. But we would used to ride until we got a car, until the cars came. There was only one car in Santa Cruz, and that car took us up to the farm. I married, I was 18, and he was 23. He came when he was 9 years old, I think, from the Falklands, yes. He farmed here, but of course, as I say, he died when he was 30. I had two children, a boy and a girl, and after Mark died, my stepfather died, and then I looked after Mother, just the two of us, for 22 years, yes. Just the two of us, you see what I mean, yes.
A Sunday school teacher of Mother's used to send a big parcel of all the books, copy books, pencils, rubbers, and everything, every year. And that's how we were taught. And she used to give us a Bible lesson every Sunday and sing hymns. Mother, she had the memory and father had the voice. The two younger ones, they had the advantage of going to the national school. They learned the language, because I never learned to speak the Spanish. I talked this, but my own way, because I was left a widow very young, and I had to manage the farm. And it was all done with Spanish. But I managed, I got through.
I've been walking for 3 days now along a track along the southern shore of Lake Carrera. That's the huge lake, the second largest in South America, which straddles the divide between Chile and Argentina. A track for horses, a mule track, winding its way over the cliffs and ramparts which make up the southern side of the lake. I'm walking towards the town of Chile Chico and the Argentine border. The town of Facinal I passed about 5 kilometers back, and it consisted of 3 houses. I'm walking down the road, and although it does show signs of having had vehicles on it at one time in its life, I don't really hold out much hope of bumping into anything. It's going to be a long, hard grind. Horizon after horizon, sometimes without a single sign of human life. Coming fresh from Europe, I found this emptiness scary. On the high, gravelly plains, I could walk for days, meeting only sheep or perhaps an ostrich, hearing only the wind and the cry of the bandurria, the bird they call the policeman of the pampas. It was just this emptiness that appealed to the early settlers. Some of them were on the run from poverty back home. One or two were maverick adventurers. But the vast majority were drawn to Patagonia by what has always been its greatest single asset, practically limitless grazing land for sheep. The Scots in particular saw the potential of this. From Dumfriesshire, the Highlands and even the Outer Hebrides, farming families made the long transatlantic voyage to Punta Arenas on the Magellan Strait.
My father was Malcolm Mackay, and you couldn't get a more Scottish name than that. My mother was also from the island of Lewis. They were both from the island of Lewis. They got married in 1921, and my mother was very happy on the farm. It was very lonely. She never saw another woman, sometimes for a year or more. But it didn't seem to bother her. It was a very sort of orderly life. There was no great stress attached to it. It was just up in the morning and do work all day, and then early to bed. There was no radio, no television at that time. And the letters from Scotland took at least a month coming. And my parents went back to Scotland in 1960. My father had been in Patagonia for 45 years and my mother 39. So they went back home. It was a very sad leave-taking, but they wanted to go home to Scotland. That was their great goal.
This is something very interesting about the British community throughout Patagonia's history. They've always regarded home as being back in the old country, yes. Haven't they?
Yes, and a lot of them went back. But there's some old shepherds, Patagonian shepherds. If you go to the cemetery, you'll find lots of Scottish names on the tombstones, like MacLean and MacLeod and names like that.
Talking about home, you were born here, yeah, of Scottish parents, but what do you think of as home?
Punta Arenas. I have been here for over 50 years, well, about 55 years anyway, and this is home to me.
But 100 years ago, the farm where Peggy Fell lives belonged to the Tehuelche Indians. It was an unfenced wilderness, the home of ostriches, puma and guanaco, a sort of llama. When the British arrived, bringing sheep by the thousand, the Indians could hardly believe their luck.
What happened that the Indians used to live hunting, see? And all of a sudden they saw sheep in the camps. And they used to kill the sheep because they could never believe that that belonged to somebody, all the sheep they came. They thought God sent them that sheep for them. So it was easy to catch a sheep, more easier than catch a guanaco. So also the Indian used to attack the white man, and white man also used to kill them because to defend themselves. And afterwards, two ships came with Marines, and they round about 300 Indians, put them on the ship and took them to Isla Dawson, Dawson Island. But these Indians were hunters. They didn't know about nothing about fishing, see? They only knew about hunting. And there were no guanacos there, no rears or yandus, as we call it, see? That's why they died of hunger.
At the heart of Patagonia are endless grazing lands, stretching from the Atlantic to the high Andes, westward into Chile, and south to Tierra del Fuego. The sheep farms here, or estancias as they're called, are some of the biggest and remotest in the world. You could fit London into one of them and have space left over. In January and February, the southern summer, sheep are driven by the thousand to the shearing sheds, where gangs of shearers sweat it out for up to 15 hours a day. Some farms still use hand clippers, but most are mechanised, though the equipment has perhaps seen better days.
I'm now at Estancia Chacabuco, and this machinery is all driven by a 54-year-old diesel engine, made in England, I'm glad to say, and this engine is driving 11 shearing posts. And although it seems to me that the amount of wool coming off isn't quite as much as with the hand shearer, it's certainly more efficient in terms of time and energy. From the shearing posts, an army of lads is taking the fleeces to a sorting table where they're graded, ready for baling.
Well, down in Jose Menendez, that was a thriving sheep farm because they had over 100,000 sheep. Dad was working the big engines for the sheep because there were, to show, 5,000 sheep a day. There were 30 shearers and 2 press boxes, and 5 or 6 pressmen, so my father had all that to look after.
You saw drives of 1,000 or 2,000, or even more sometimes. When we were fairly near the coast, it was about a week or 10 days, but from the lakes, a drive could be a month or 2 months.
We were living in Pickett Harbour, a farm about an hour away from Punta Arenas, but very much run on a system whereby the shepherds had British head shepherds. The truck drivers had a British mechanic superintendent. It was all worked out fairly well.
The shepherds used to go out to see the sheep, and the sheep used to be stranded and buried in the snow. And after the sheep used to make like a igloos inside, but covered all. And they used to live there for 40 days and 40 nights under the snow there. And the shepherds used to look for them, and sometimes they find them, sometimes not. But the dogs used to find them because they knew the sheep used to make a little hole with the breathing. And they used to have air to come in that way in nature.
And in the spring, where they had plenty, they had to take on men. Must have been shepherds and bullock carters. Then they had a little train that took the bales of wool down from the farm down to the beach. Boats came from England to take the wool away.
It's the last day of the shearing at Estancia Chacabuco, and so tonight, of course, it will be party time. It's been a grueling 3 weeks for these men, day after day. 72,000 sheep have come through, and so you can imagine their feelings as the last of those 72,000 come down the production line to receive their haircut.
Had a British club here some years ago, and I remember we had very jolly times in the British club. Every year we used to have the Caledonian ball and have the Scottish dancing, and during the year we'd have people that came from Scotland and taught us the different dances, which was very enjoyable. We had a really lovely time.
We made our own amusements. We had very good neighbors, and it wasn't a weekend, but what we used to visit each other and play cards, and everybody could play an accordion or a violin, and there was music, and we would have a dance, and they would come for one day, and maybe they would stay 2 days.
And we all used to have picnics, or at winter time it was a dance at night for any of those special things, like Christmas, New Year, and that sort of thing. Casa Grande always gave the Christmas dance. It was quite nice in a way, but I didn't know, I wasn't too keen on it because it was an awful lot of windy after the wind. And it was cold in winter time, wet.
The wind, always the wind. They say that Patagonia without wind would be like hell without the devil. The bells used to warn shipping that this is one of the most dangerous coasts in the world. Skeletons of ironclad steamships litter the shores.
I seem to spend half my time crossing rivers. This is the Pucha Bran, looking horribly swollen after some heavy rain we had yesterday. And I've taken off my boots and socks and rolled up my trouser legs, although I think it'll come a lot higher than my knees. I've got myself a big stick to act as a third leg and perhaps hold me against the current. Oh, it's cold. Oh, why do I do this? The current is quite fast, beginning to take me now, but my third stick is standing me in good stead so far. You move the stick, move a leg, move the stick, move the leg, up to my knees, getting faster and stronger. It's quite terrifying, this current, the way it drags you. I'm about halfway now, past the deepest bit, and wading slowly and painfully towards the other side. Whew. Oh. I better get my boots on before I catch pneumonia.
In the valley of the River Chubut, 700 miles north of Tierra del Fuego, I found a close-knit band of settlers from a different part of Britain. The names give them away: Maya Davis, Archie Griffiths, And then Freddie Green, a 79-year-old farmer and radio ham who's made a study of the Welsh in Patagonia.
100 years ago, there was a lot of migration from Wales, and there were a few persons, amongst them was my grandfather, Richard Jones Berwyn, and Michael Jones of Bala, Lewis Jones of Carnarvon, who tried to direct part of that migration to a certain part of the world where they could keep their traditions, language, their religion, and they found that in Patagonia.
They weren't out to seek their fortunes. Most were simply escaping from years of exploitation under their English landlords. Of all Patagonia's immigrants, these are the ones who've kept the ways of their forefathers. They arrived in 1865 on a chartered tea clipper, the Mimosa. Their leaders had promised a land of pastures and forests, but what they found was more or less a desert. Must have been quite a shock for families brought up in wet Welsh valleys. They struggled to cultivate the sandy soil. Some died of disease, others at the hands of the Indians. One or two starved to death. Within a few years, the whole colony had come to the brink of collapse.
And it happened that Aaron Jenkins and his wife, which I believe was named Margaret Jenkins, I believe, went on a Sunday afternoon to have a look at the wheat. And it was drying up, shriveling. And Mrs. Jenkins noticed that the level of the water in the river was higher than what had been sown. And so she said to her husband, but just look here, we could bring water from the river. Well, we'll come back. That was a Sunday afternoon. And they didn't do a job like that on Sunday at that time. But they came back on Monday and dug a ditch from the river and irrigated the wheat there. And that was the secret. From then on, they knew how to raise wheat in Chubut Valley.
Well, Westman, he offered father to look after a little camp he had up in Chubut. There was just a shed on it and no house. So father and my sister and brother cut down trees and then put them up like a sort of a log cabin affair, and like put mud between them and other small branches. And so that made a sort of a home for us. I can remember it had an entrance right up to where he made a fireplace. And the fireplace, he put a tin on top. And then when they were well-burned cinders, he made a place for the bread underneath with a lid on it. And so we cooked our bread. Well, at least mother did. Then there were bedrooms on each side, father and mother's. An odd visitor's one, if we'd ever have such a thing. And for ourselves and for my two little brothers. Father and mother thought it was a very wild place to bring up a family, so they sort of gave it over, yes. Well, we tried another place then, but the man sort of let him down, and so we just lived really behind the bush, as they say, in a place called Trevelyne.
John Daniel Evans, he was the leader. He was the man who had the vision. He had been brought off the sailboat to Mimosa on his father's arm. And he had been brought up with the Indians down there. He talked their language the same as they did. And they talked Welsh, because almost every family down there at that time would have Indian children with them for schooling and that sort of thing. Because my grandfather, Richard Jones Berwin, he was the first school teacher in Patagonia. Okay, now then, the Indians had told them about wonderful lands up in the Andes, which had rivers, lakes, and forests. And he always explored, looking for gold. And he was looking for gold on the rivers in this part of the world. And he found some, but never of much value. So the best fortune he found was the land, with plenty of rainfall and possibility to farm.
But Patagonians have never been able to relax in their struggle for survival. Now, 100 years on, the Welsh and the Scots and the English and all the other people here are being threatened again. Drought and economic collapse are striking at the old traditions. International politics are forcing all Patagonians to decide where their loyalties lie. The outside world, once literally a world apart, is hammering on Patagonia's door.